Welcome to This Week in Craft Beer, the podcast, the weekly show where we interview the people making the magic happen in the UK craft beer scene. This Week in Craft Beer publishes the UK's leading craft beer newsletter every Monday morning by email. To subscribe for free, please visit www.thisweekincraft.beer. This Week in Craft Beer would like to thank our generous Patreon supporters, John Stevens, Nick Flynn, Jamie Ramsey, Sue Johnson, Steve Hartley, Jazz Hundell, Phantom Brewing Company, Dolphin Brewery, Bayonet Brewing Co., The Paper Mill Micropub, Doug Thayer, Robert Baker, Aid Bardi, Berkshire Beer Box, and The Small Batch Brewing Co. So I'm delighted to welcome to the podcast today Bruce from Left-Handed Giant, based in Bristol. Left-Handed Giant originally started with a beer handed across to small bar owners, Bruce Gray and Jack Granger. The beer was made by Rich Poole, who eventually set up shop on a small kit in the back of the same bar, fermenting the thought of a cuckoo brewery that became Left-Handed Giant. From its start in 2014, the brewery grew in stages, first by securing its own premises in the summer of 2017, and more recently in the latter part of 2019, a second flagship location of a brew pub based in the centre of Bristol in Finsel's Reach, overlooking the harbour off the River Avon. Bruce, please introduce yourself and tell me about your beer journey, which led you to launching Left-Handed Giant.
What a lovely intro. Thank you so much for having me. I am Bruce Gray, and I am one of the founders of Left-Handed Giant based in Bristol.
Excellent. So how did it all start, Bruce? When did you see the light?
When did I see, oh, geez, there's a question that's difficult to answer. My hospitality journey, I think that's it. Because, I mean, fundamentally, I'm a bar guy.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I'm illustrated by the fact that Left-Handed Giant began in a bar that existed before Left. You know, we had a little brew kit through the back, and the idea of Left-Handed Giant really spawned organically out of that.
Yep.
But my hospitality journey began like when I was 18, working in nightclubs and bars, the small town that I grew up in.
Right.
But my 20s were spent really completely out of the craft beer world. The area I grew up in was much more of a tenants
right.
session type of place in the, sure. in the southwest of Scotland.
Yep.
And there was no, you know, I mean, back then it was like, you know, certainly the area I was in was restricted from that side. But also, you know, the craft beer scene hadn't really began to no. take hold in the UK, never mind in the depths of a small town in Scotland. And it wasn't really until I moved to Edinburgh when I was about 28 or 29.
Right.
And started to coincide actually with a visit to the US. I went out there and spent 3 weeks with my brother traveling around various different parts of the West Coast
right.
and came across really interesting beers. You know, it was mm-hmm. like we were drinking Fat Tire
yeah.
Quite a lot. It was in a lot of different places. And I wasn't yep. looking for craft beer, but there was a real, you know, the opposite to where I'd grown up. There was a lack of just standard things that I recognize. So we drank right. a bit of Fat Tire at the start, I think, on recommendation of someone that we met out there.
Nice.
In Kenton. And then when I came back after that, moved to Edinburgh, and that kind of started me onto a bit of a real ale journey mm-hmm. rather than craft beer journey. There's some great pubs in Edinburgh.
Absolutely.
Cloisters being one of them that was mm-hmm. very close to the flat that I lived in. Really great real ale pub. And I used to go down there with my little dog and drink the various different nice. Real ales that they had on. And then a job with BrewDog came
Which
along.
Which year are we
Aberdeen.
Talking there, Bruce?
That was 2010. So that was yeah. the very, very first BrewDog bar.
Yep.
And before they opened that bar, they were looking for a manager who could take that bar on.
Right.
And at that point in my life, I was sort of between, I was floating a little bit, didn't really, I'd stopped the career I had in my 20s. I'd kind of left behind in that small town in Scotland and moved to Edinburgh, really trying to find what I was going to do with my future.
Right.
And believe it or not, when the job with BrewDog came along, I was running two kids' soft play centres.
Oh, wow.
Just really, you know, it was like I was like bouncing one thing to the next, trying to find what my future was going to be and what I was going to be able to find that would make me passionate and happy yep. and fulfilled rather than, you know, doing what I had been doing. So really, I was like, I was sitting there utterly open to new experiences. And then this job came along that was via a friend of mine. So he worked in BrewDog.
Right.
And he gave the guys a heads up that there was this manager, me.
Yep.
That was available potentially and it might be worth a conversation. So I went up to Aberdeen and had a conversation with James Watt.
Yeah.
We talked about what he wanted the bar to be, mm-hmm. what my experience was, and I got the job. And that led on to like a 2-year whirlwind of experience, really, yep. because at that point, I'd never came across what you would term, you know, what is commonly recognized as craft beer now. No. But at that point, it wasn't a thing that was in every corner. It wasn't a thing that was in every shop. It wasn't a thing that when you said the term craft beer, anyone would really, generally speaking, mm-hmm. be aware of. So it was a huge education for me to begin with. But then also from a career perspective, like I had the opportunity then, I did a good enough job in that first bar. I was given the yep. responsibility of running their bar company for them.
Yep.
And I went on to open up the next 9 bars the length of wow. the country, mm-hmm. from Aberdeen to, you know, the 2 other, Edinburgh and Glasgow and Scotland, right down to Camden, and yep. almost every major city in between, mm-hmm. including Bristol, which was my first real experience.
I've probably been to Bristol, all of those, I suspect.
Yeah, but no doubt. And, you know, I spent that 2 years really like on this huge educational journey, both yep. from beer and craft beer and what that whole scene was and what the UK developing brewery and bar scene was.
Yep.
So from a business operation perspective, I had the privilege of being involved in such a fast growing and funded business that I yes. could see so many mistakes being made, growing at that speed, yep. and lessons to be learned off the back of that. That was in an environment that actually, you know, that kind of growth speed within that kind of small company, mistakes are kind of accepted and seen as a learning curve rather than something that is a failure. And I think that's something I've taken on into everything that I've done since. But that being said, when you're growing at that speed, and I think this has been fairly well documented in the press in the last years. It's a very, 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 very challenging environment to work within. I spent 2 years within that company.
Yeah.
It was some of the most valuable time I've ever spent in my life.
I bet it was.
From a career progression perspective. Yeah. But Jesus, the pain of operating and that kind of stress and the hours yeah. I was putting into it were incredible. Mm-hmm. And I got to a point where I thought to myself that if I'm going to work that hard and I'm going to put that much myself into something, then I should be doing it for something that's mine, not someone else's. So I quit my job, much to the surprise of most of the people that I knew, because it was such a high profile. And,
oh yeah, it must have been. You know, it must have been really exciting to be part of that. That early
yeah, stage, right? And I think most people that I knew were really surprised by the decision and saw it as being more stupid than brave. Uh-huh. But I set off and set up a business in Scotland. There was a wholesale company we used to bring in. At that point, you know, craft beer was just a fledgling thing. So we began to buy craft beer by the pallet into a big yellow storage unit in the middle of Edinburgh.
Nice.
And then we hired vans and distributed that beer round about Scotland.
Mostly US opened, or...
UK. No. UK. Okay, so right. You know, back then it was like Buxton, Magic Rock, okay. Thornbridge. Yeah,
got it.
You know, those real mm-hmm. early days, you know, the first guys.
Yeah, Colonel Brubenham was probably in that mix.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Colonel, yeah, exactly. You know, that wave one of craft breweries coming through. And we opened a bar called The Hanging Bat, which is still there,
where I was
on Lothian Road, which I think was the first bar to not serve pints in the UK.
Oh, okay.
That lasted for a year or so. But again, I was putting, you know, an awful lot of work into that. Felt like, you know, I was a 1/3 partner in that business. Felt really like I could do it my own. And I packed up sticks. My wife is from South Wales. I'd spent some time in Bristol with BrewDog when we were opening the bar down here for BrewDog, and felt like Bristol was really a city that had a desire and willingness to support small independent business
rather than breweries or bars necessarily.
Just business, and by extension would support small independent breweries or bars. So the thought of opening a bar like we'd opened in Edinburgh, like The Hanging Bat, which really is a showcase of small independent UK small independent breweries, I felt like if we opened a bar like that in the middle of Bristol, people would support it. And that transpired to be the case. And we opened Small Bar in 2013 and Smallbar still there, still operating in exactly the same manner as it has been since 2013 as a showcase.
Bruce. The same footprint of shop, because it's kind of two units sort of knocked through, isn't it? So was it always those two?
Always been. So funny, it's not a particularly small bar. The name is about the people that we represent rather than the size of the bar. So it's about small independent producers rather than being the small premises. But I always think it's quite a nice conversational point when people walk in, because they expect it to be small, and that allows a chance to talk to people about why it's actually called Small Bar.
And so you move, you're only 200 yards from Brewdog, of course, the original Brewdog in Bristol. Was there anything else of, you know, even vaguely sort of crafty note down there when you moved in? Or
I mean, there was, so funnily enough, and at the same time, King Street, now it is seen as like one of the beer streets in the UK, shoulder to shoulder, great beer. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when we took the lease on at Small Bar, there was nothing there. The street was almost empty.
Not even pubs? No hospitality at all? No,
they were all shut down.
Right.
You were down to, there would have been two or three that were still open. And the street really had lost its gravity, lost its way. A bunch of empty pubs down there. But then within the summer, the year that we opened up, the Volley, the famous Royal Navy Volunteer Tavern across the road, opened up at 3 months before us, focusing on great beer.
Yeah.
And the Beer Emporium opened up about a month after them.
Right.
And then we opened up about 2 months after them. So it was like this, you know, within a very, very short space of time, you had these three bars that were all focused on, in their own manner, great beer. And all of a sudden it created a gravity and an interest and a pull down to King Street, which has only been increased as the years have gone by and more and more places have opened up. Yeah.
Wow. Perfect timing. Well, timing and you know, I guess perfect time to contribute to making that happen as well. So you know, partly it was serendipitous, but also partly your hard work that it's come together. Yeah, brilliant.
As with most things, I think in my journey, and I think if people are honest in most people's journey, it's more luck than judgment. I think certainly there was some judgment with what we did when we did it, but you know, the timing of when we opened that bar. And then by extension, you know, because there's a part of the story I'm not telling here, actually. So at the same time as opening Small Bar, we started a wholesale company down here as well.
Okay.
So very, 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 very similar model to what we were doing up in Scotland. So I was bringing down the very best UK small independent breweries into the Southwest and distributing that and hire vans around the Southwest.
Nice.
And that allowed Small Bar really to access, like, you know, we really showcased the very pick of those pallets that were coming in from the best independent breweries in Small Bar. So Small Bar always had, like, you know, the very best beer list in the Southwest.
Yes.
But also at the same time, it opened up an availability of the best craft beer in the UK to the bars within the Southwest. All of a sudden, there was like, it wasn't just a desire to drink these kind of, there was an availability of those kind of beers as well.
Right.
So I think, you know, the two things probably worked side by side quite well, and like, you know, having the showcase venue at Small Bar and then having those beers starting to feed their way out into the wider market as well. Yeah. And allowing any bar owners, bar managers that did want to showcase those beers, the availability of those beers without having to buy in pallets themselves. So really was like the 2013 through 2017 probably in Bristol, there was like a real change of the beer scene.
Right.
From like the, you know, the available interesting beer would be traditional cast lead type venues through to being real like craft beer keg type of venues being available.
Absolutely. I mean, it's still a really strong cask market in Bristol.
It still exists alongside, but you know, the keg side, the craft beer side, obviously didn't exist up until that point, and it really came along and flourished alongside the cask market. They still exist.
I've had quite a few guests on the podcast from the Southwest, actually. You know,
really,
who you know, the likes of Pipeline and Padworth Padstow, I should say, not Padworth, I just made up a town.
Padstow,
and I've had Sam from Vessel, of course, these guys are all, you know, in various sort of different ways bemoaned the geography of the Southwest and the fact that everywhere's sort of so far from everywhere else and the difficulties getting good beer in and getting their beer out as well. And, you know, so I guess you, in Bristol there, you can play a really important sort of connectivity role there in both directions to get Southwest beer into the rest of the country and bring bring great beer in. So, good for you. Let's, before we go any further, Bruce, lots more to talk about on that direction. Let's talk about his first beer. I'm cracking into Sky Above. I have had this before several times in the brew pub on draft. To my mind, this is one of the best sort of pintable pails in Britain. You know, to sort of use that overused hackneyed phrase, but this beer is brilliant on a sunny day or any other day in a pint glass with the sun shining. But the tasting notes say our house session pale, easy drinking and hop forward. It features an extra pale malt base combined with Citra, Simcoe and Mosaic to create a crisp, sessionable ale with bright citrus notes. Yeah, absolutely gorgeous. Perfect afternoon beer. And I'd be curious just to get a bit of background on this one from you.
Yeah, so I mean, we are, we always have been and are committed to remaining a pub-led brewery. So obviously we make big ABV, big impactful products as well.
Sure,
But at the heart of what we do, our beers should be sessionable, drinkable from a glass, always enjoyed best in the place that they are produced, like the brew pub where you've been drinking Sky Above. Sky Above echoes right back to the very first beer we ever made, which was Left-Handed Giant Pale. Mm-hmm. And this very much, while the recipe is developed and the branding is developed, essentially this is that, a beer that we designed to be drank from a glass in a pub, in company, and to be something that is just super sessionable, super crisp, super enjoyable, and want you to go back to the bar and grab another one. And that's what it's all about.
Perfect. And what sort of percentage of your production output would this represent, Bruce? Any ideas?
Sky Above will be in the region of 20-25% of our total production. Yeah, so it's like it's large, but it's not a huge proportion of our production. We've got because we've got the brew pub, small bar, and a couple other places in Bristol. We can't have one beer that is a huge proportion of it because we need those venues to have a nice breadth of different products.
Oh, definitely.
So we've got two different beers for Sky Above, which is our most popular beer. Both within the brew house, I think it's probably what we enjoy making the most, as well as what the customers enjoy. So there's a nice happenstance there where, you know, the customer demand marries up with what we like to make and what we like to drink ourselves. But you've got Hazy Pale as well, which is also a 4.5% beer, just a more heavily hot forward, a bit of a thicker body and a bit more East Coast type of pale ale rather than Sky Above. So those two, but Hazy Pale probably sits as like 10-ish% of total production.
Right.
But equally, you've got in the pubs, you've got these two different beers, which are same ABV, same kinds of profile, taking up, over a third of our total production.
Yeah, and they're always on everywhere, basically. In your outlets,
That's what we try. So we don't always achieve that, but that's our intention. Certainly.
Yeah, got it. Nice. So let's talk about brewing then, Bruce, because we've told the small bar story at least to start with. How did this bar become a brewery?
Yeah. So we had a little brew kit through the back of small bar. And I think one of the things I learned at BrewDog was that people behind the bar feel so much more bought in and passionate about the product when they know the process goes into when it ceases to just be a product coming through the tap and it becomes something that is a sum of the raw ingredients that has went into it.
Mm-hmm.
So we put the little brew kit through the back of small bar with the intention that we would just do some brews on it. Wouldn't be a massive commercial thing. It'd just be something that the team in the bar could get their hands on, learn the brewing process, and hopefully get a little bit excited about. And a guy called Rich Poole, who is an integral part of the story, but at that time he was a semi-commercial brewer. Mm-hmm. He had a little 50-litre kit in his garage.
Right.
Had developed a brewery and a brand called Rocket Science. And he persuaded his boss to let him cut back to 4 days a week, and he would spend 1 day a week in his garage making beer. And then he would go around town and he would sell the kegs from the back of his car into the pubs that would have it. And Jack Granger, other co-founder of Left Handed Giant was the manager of Small Bar at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew Rich from his previous job in the hair, running the Hare in the Hills. He used to buy a large proportion of Rich's rocket science beer in the Hare in the Hill.
Right.
So when Giant moved across to Small Bar, he continued to buy a large proportion of Rich's rocket science product into Small Bar. And Jack and I would be in Small Bar drinking this rocket science beer that was made in a 50 litre kit in a little garage in Yates that was standing up quality wise next to, you know, the big guns of the craft beer scene at that point, and just be incredulous as to how that was possible.
Yep.
And Jack was already friends with Rich. I became friends with Rich throughout that first year. And it became apparent that he was incredibly passionate about beer and brewing, but less so about running a business,
right,
less so about quitting his job and taking the risk to, you know, raise investment and set up a brewery. It seemed like between us, between Jack, Rich and I, we had the skills that, I think that, you know, the rounded skills that might make up a brewery. Mm-hmm. Often it's a home brewer or a professional brewer who sets up a brewery and has the ability to make the beer, but not so much the ability to look after the accounts.
This is so true.
The payroll, the HR, the sales side of it. Or it's someone who's good at sales and starts a brewery, doesn't have the ability to make the bleeding beer.
Yeah. I mean, it's a rare person that covers all those bases, isn't it?
That's absolutely. Yeah. And I certainly don't. And no one else in our business does. But I think that between the three of us, we really do cover not all of the skill sets, clearly, but, you know, enough of them that there's very few real weaknesses within what we did from the start. And I think that really set us up in a good stead from the get-go. We also had an established company. We had, you know, that wholesale company that was running in the background that had a, you know, we were in control of that route to market. You know, we had the ability to put beer in back of vans and run it around the Southwest. And Small Bar as a showcase for this beer.
Yeah.
So it was like, you know, we were certainly one or two steps ahead of most small breweries when they set up, just because of the things that we already had going. So we set up off the back of that little brewery in the back of Small Bar. But right at the start, we were also brewing in other people's kit around the Southwest. There's an interesting little addition to that story with Wiper and True, who I guess you know. So Wiper and True started off being a brewery who utilised other people's brewery. They have their own brewery.
Yep.
And in early 2015, they launched their own brewery. So they withdrew from the places that they brewed in round about the Southwest.
Right.
Michael and all of us are good friends. And Michael was kind enough to give us the contacts of the people that he
sort of
brewed.
The capacity.
We literally stepped into Wiper and True's shoes. It was like, you know, they started brewing their own kit. They left the capacity available in other people's breweries, and we stepped right into the shoes that they left.
That's
within
awesome.
Those breweries. And we did that for 2 years. So, you know, we brewed in that little kit in Small Bar. We did a lot of collaborations in that kit, you know, a lot of fun things in that kit. But mostly we built the brand off the back of brewing in the, you know, 15-barrel, 25-barrel breweries, three ones specifically around about the Southwest, and making far bigger batches, you know, selling them in Small Bar and selling them out through our route to market in the Southwest, but also using our contacts around the UK as well and doing some export through that period as well.
Right.
Until it got to 2017, where I think our journey had always been aiming towards getting to the point where our volume was big enough that we could confidently build our own brewery and then fill that brewery. So rather than building a brewery and then having to find the sales to fill that brewery up, you know, we built the sales first and then built the brewery once we were confident that the volume was consistent enough to be using that brewery to its full capacity.
Nice.
So we did that in 2017. And it still in hindsight kind of shocks me how quickly we then rolled from that point through to what happened next. Because over the course of 2 years, we built that first brewery. So for the first time, we're actually, you know, operating a commercial brewery. But then within 2 years, had crowdfunded over £1 million, had built Finzel's, fitted that out, opened it, and also built a whole new, far larger brewery at St. Philip's, where our original brewery was, into a bigger unit next door. And that all happened really, like, at the time, it seemed like quite a long time, but in hindsight, it was not a long time at all. It was like 2017 committed to it, and then it was just like a rolling snowball down a hill from that point through till the pandemic, actually.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Um, uh, And then the pandemic really was like our snowball got squelched.
Yeah. But you're here, you're still here to smile about it. So
still here, yes. It was like, but yeah, the momentum certainly got stalled.
Yes.
And it turned from being like a thing that was like in growth constantly to being a thing that was, you know, we were struggling to fight to maintain volume, to maintain our business in reality.
Yep. Oh, absolutely.
Happily, those times have passed and we're back to, you know, this last year has seen us back into growth, is back into increasing volume.
Brilliant.
And back into utilising the full capacity of both of our breweries. I think that's 8 years of our life just condensed into about 5 minutes there. So I think I succinctly covered it all, but I probably missed a few bits and pieces.
No, that was great, Bruce. It's nearly half an hour actually, but some good stuff in there. I would say, you know, I think obviously your that period of crazy growth in 2017, 2019 sort of coincided with a period of crazy growth for the industry in the UK, I guess.
Yes.
So you were really riding the wave there when there was perhaps less serious competition than there is today as well, perhaps. I don't know whether that's a fair comment or not. But
well, you know. I think certainly the early part of that, you know, that 2015 through 2018, I think be fair to say, I think by the time that the 18-19 came along, there was a lot of competition in the marketplace already.
Yep. Oh, definitely.
And even then, you could start to see the from a wholesale perspective, you know, sales not through our own venues, but just out to the wider market, out to the export market, becoming much more challenging.
Yeah.
Brexit, you know, January 2020,
yeah.
I think kind of gets like, I think the impact of that into small business, you know, breweries, but just small business generally speaking in the UK, I think the impact of that gets hidden in among the chaos of the next 2 years.
Yeah.
But you can, you know, I think, you know, I've said this in the past, but whatever way you lean, politically, I think it is difficult to deny that's the case.
No question.
There's certainly in my mind absolutely no doubt that even if the pandemic hadn't happened, there would have been a reckoning within UK small business off the back of the loss of the export market that existed prior to Brexit. You're right. You know, certainly the, you know, our years of growth, that, like, again, more luck than judgment. You know, we opened in 2015. Certainly it wasn't like we opened in 2015 with a big headline at the top of our business plan being like, here exists an opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
We just thought it was like there was three people there that had the necessary skill sets to do something we thought would be fun. And it transpired that it coincided with years of real aggressive growth and demand for craft beer in the UK. Much more luck than judgment that side of it. but we had the skills, the drive,
to deliver the quality product, everything else.
To stay in the wave that was rolling along behind us. And there's no doubt that leading through to 18-19, and then obviously there was the cliff edge of, you know, 2021 and through to now, where that without doubt, you know, you had that period where demand far outstripped supply.
Yeah.
And I think you can fairly well say that it's flipped in entirely the opposite direction now.
It has.
Painfully.
Yeah. It has. Let's take a short break, Bruce. So I'm back with Bruce from Left-Handed Giant for the second half of the show. Bruce, at this stage every week, I like to put my guest on the spot and ask them to tell me what makes them different. What is it you're doing or are planning to do at Left-Handed Giant to stand out in the somewhat crowded UK craft beer scene?
That's an interesting question, because there's a bunch of different answers to that from a bunch of different perspectives. But the thing that I would like people to think of us, and it probably as the time goes on more and more, is to look at us as a business which is ran and operated by people who are utterly invested into what we do. And the way we do that is by offering employee ownership to our team in the short term via small proportions of ownership. But what we're building towards, what we have been building towards since the crowdfund in 2018, is a majority owned employee-owned business, which from a brewery perspective doesn't exist in the UK yet at all. So, you know, what I would like the company to be, what we've always wanted the company to be, is run by people that don't just work for the company, but work within a company that they love, that they feel valued in, that they feel they are part of, at the front of it, but at the very base of it as well. I think that the way business is operated globally, fairly well, is not particularly conducive to your average person. And I've not came from money. You know, the foundations of this business has came from hustle. And building something out of absolutely nothing. I've been in poverty. I've been in places where I've not known how I'm going to pay for my rent that week, never mind that month. And I know how it feels. And I'm utterly committed that we build a company that looks after people, that ensures the people that work in the company are not like that, but it also ensures that we're not just running a company where the profit is squeezing out the back end of it to enrich shareholders. The profit is going to the people that work in the company and enriching them, turning them from being where they are into having comfortable lives, being able to buy their own houses. And that goes to people behind the bar as well, to people in the brewery. That's, you know, there's a journey we've been on. You know, we've already done that to a degree, but the intention is, you know, the next 2 to 3 years, we should be in a position where we can buy the shares back, or the company can buy the shares back off of our crowdfund investors, and we should be able to pass those shares directly on to our employees. At the same time, it'll be a case of myself and the other two founders passing some of our shares into a pot, which allows the team to take a 51%+ ownership of the company. At which point, we will be the first UK majority employee owned company. And I hope, you know, the customer experience then is it continues to be adjusting. It's like you're looking at the company, not just a company that makes beer, but a company that's that makes beer by the people that own the company. That makes beer for a higher purpose than just selling booze. You know, it's for the enrichment of the community, the people that work within the company. And that, you know, I think that, you know, that matters to me. It matters to the people that work within the company. And I would like to think that, you know, fundamentally, and we all make beer, but, you know, I think that's what makes us different.
That's brilliant. Can I dig a little deeper on that then, Bruce, as much as you're able and willing to sort of describe what you've accomplished so far down that path? Because I've had several conversations with other brewers that have sort of expressed intentions in this direction, but I don't think anybody's perhaps got as far down the road as you have. So I'd be really curious to hear, how does that sort of work today? You know, do you get, you know, just to sort of float a few things, do you sort of get some shares when you join, and then, you know, an annual kind of bump on it, or, you know, is it based on performance? What metrics define it?
So in the short term, it's based on what's called an EMI scheme, just employee management incentive scheme. What that means is, on a yearly basis, there's a proportion of the company passed into a pot at a value. Now, traditionally, what that means, this may get complicated. I'll try and keep it simple. What that means essentially is that, in the event of a sale of the company, the difference in value when those shares were promised to the employees and the value at which the company is sold, the employees get to benefit from that difference in value. So that's what it is in the short term. Now, obviously, we're never intending on selling our company to a third party, but we will sell our company essentially to our employees when the employee ownership comes along. So they'll get to benefit from the difference in value from point A to point B in the first place, along with taking ownership of the majority shareholding of the company. So that's the EMI scheme in the short term. The employee ownership trust, which is what will happen when the employees take the majority shareholding, it's a totally separate mechanism in which the employees actually take shareholding. So the EMI scheme is...
From a profit share, or, you know, a dividend of some sort,
From a dividend perspective, because it's not a profit share. That perspective is genuinely a dividend perspective. It's there's a real ownership of the company, and there's a real release of dividend should there be profit, obviously. But employee ownership trust is there's always conversations about employee ownership floating around. There's a couple of different breweries that I know that claim to be employee owned. The reality is that they are using EMI schemes, which is not really employee owned. And I would never term myself as being 100% employee owned at this stage, because we're not. We're aiming towards that point. We're using an EMI scheme as an intermediary point between now and then to incentivize and in the long term enrich our employees. Yeah, but employee ownership trust is the, you know, that's got to be the, that's got to be the long term goal for us, certainly, to allow our employees to take real ownership, take real control of the company. But at that point, obviously, the, you know, the employee ownership trust is a, it's something that has been used around the world. There's a couple of high profile examples in the US. Generally speaking, it's looked at quite cynically because there is an opportunity within an employee ownership trust for the owners to set their own price. That's what happens. To set a price that is large, to take debt to achieve that price and leave the employees with a company which has been saddled with an absolute pile of debt. So there's moral and immoral ways of going about an employee ownership trust. And there should be transparency over that. Certainly, you know, our intention is to do it in a manner where there's a price set and the employees, the money's not taken out on day one. The money's paid out over time from available profits. So the employees can go forward. You know, there'll be an agreement where only X can get taken out to pay off the previous debt of the previous shareholders, leaving some dividends for the employees. So it's like, you know, the ongoing good performance of the companies in the interest of both the old shareholders who were bought out and the new shareholders, the employees via dividends. So there's definitely, you know, there's a, as I said, you know, there's moral and immoral ways of going about these. And certainly my intention is to set a balanced structure that allows the people, you know, me included, who have set the company up to be paid for the shares that we've got, but do it in the long term, not do it in the short term, not saddle the company with debt from a high street bank who punt a huge interest rate onto it. And I think that allows the opportunity for the employees to take ownership in a manner that allows them to have long-term stability in the company and have the ability to both benefit from dividends in the short term, but benefit from the company going forward, being in profit and growing in value.
Fantastic.
So yeah, there's a you know, between those two schemes, employee ownership trust and EMI, there's a lot of different methods of executing both things and a lot of different complications within both of them. But certainly we have, you know, we've went through the EMI journey already. You know, I've done a huge amount of research into the EOT journey. Both are massively worthwhile things. But the EOT side of things, I think for any founder-operated business, when the founder is looking to transition back from the front end of the business, it's a hugely beneficial thing. And I would urge that anyone around the UK who's operating a small independent brewery to look into it and discover what it is, because you know, on both sides, I think it's massively beneficial. You know, get your employees utterly bought into what the business, the longevity of a the longevity of a small independent brand. You know, you sell out to Heineken, you utterly undermine. You might enrich yourself, but gee, you utterly undermine everything that you have built that business be. Whereas with an employee ownership trust, you know, you can preserve, you can allow yourself to step back from the front end of the business, but you can also, I think, along with empowering and enriching your employees, preserve the integrity of the dream, the thing that you've set up way into the future. I think it's a hugely beneficial thing that I think specifically within craft beer, you know, the type of businesses that we all set up that has so much of ourselves, our souls, so much passion as part of the brand proposition, if you like, that it's difficult for it not to be the people that run the company that own it and still keep that integrity.
That's I love that last point particularly, Bruce, because I think, you know, this is a, you know, a sort of a story which is very precious to me, is the you know, the independence of these amazing craft brewers who got in the UK. And, you know, thank goodness the trend of the bigger ones selling out, you know, was a, you know, a thing 3 or 4 years ago. It doesn't seem to have really sustained, and thank goodness for that. But at the same time, I absolutely acknowledge and respect the right of the people that put their blood, sweat and tears into building these businesses to cash out at some point. So it's a really, it's a difficult conflict to resolve in, you know, isn't it? That it sounds as though you've potentially found quite an elegant way to do that. And I'm not saying that's the only thing you're doing here, but that's, you know, it's one really nice aspect of it, isn't it?
Yeah. I hope so, certainly. I hope so.
Well, I will drink to that, and I'm going to toast it with Sibling Rivalry, 7% West Coast IPA. This is a collab, actually, with the Small Bar team, which is really cool. Brewed to celebrate the 9th birthday of the Small Bar, Tasty notes I have say sibling rivalry is stacked with an old school classic West Coast lineup of Centennial, Amarillo, Columbus, and Simcoe. Clear, polished copper in appearance, which is a lovely description, and refreshingly balanced on the palate. The bitterness is firm, crisp, and backed up by hop notes of candied peach and grapefruit. Lovely, Westy. This it's not bitter enough to sort of threaten the the back of my throat or the enamel on my teeth. It's clearly identifiably a West Coast IPA, but with the fruit flavors which such a beer needs these days, I think, you know, it's not just enough to be bitter anymore, is it? It's got to have some really punchy fruit flavors, yeah. and those are here. So another lovely beer. What's the story here, Bruce?
As you said, it's Small Bar's 9th birthday, and to be fair, all of us, I think, you know, with some nostalgia, look back to the beer scene that existed when we set Small Bar up, when we set Left Hand and Giant up, 2013, 14, 15, and these were the beers.
They were.
isn't it incredible? Like the change in what is a popular IPA over the course of only 9 years. I will be talked about doing a collaboration for Small Bar's birthday. I think everyone unanimously were keen to brew a proper West Coast IPA. Right. It's something that harked back to those early years of both businesses. Yeah. But then, you know, across the brewers as well as the Small Bar team, I think this is a style of beer. I think we all wish there was a bigger demand for, so we could brew more of.
Yeah.
Particularly, you know, Rich, co-founder, head brewer. I think these are the beers. These beers are the ones he really excels at.
Mm-hmm.
Probably because they're the ones he cares.
Again, you know, that was what he came up probably brewing.
That's it. It's the ones that he loves to drink. I think he really excels. And I think, you know, whenever we make them, Cheeseburger Cavalry is like definitely not as true a West Coast as you're drinking there. Mm-hmm. But it has that, you know, it harks back to those types of flavors. Yeah, so that was a celebration of Small Bar's 9th birthday, nice. and it was a nostalgic hark back to the beers that were popular back in, you know, when it began for us.
I'm about to say something stupid, but I'm going to say it anyway. I think 7% is the perfect ABV for an IPA stroke pale beer. You know, there's no real way to justify that, and it, you know, it's an irresponsible perhaps thing to say, but for me, that's that is the sweet spot of ABV. It's strong enough to have that sort of little alcohol sort of buzz with it, but it's not so strong that you're going to be on your back if you were foolish enough to drink a pint of it. So yeah,
I'm with you. You have those dials that are required to be turned to allow there to be the amplification of the various different flavors in there. And when you're making like a hop forward beer, it's difficult to really lean into that on a lower ABV. And obviously there's a balance to be had. I'm with you, like that 7% area. Tell you that beer, Cheeseburger Cavalry set to 6.9%, very similar. I'm with you. Certainly it's not conducive to slinging a few pints of it down your throat, but it's very, very conducive to enjoying a small amount.
Definitely. And it's all right, because the Portman Group don't listen to this podcast, so we'll be fine. let's talk about the brew pub. Bruce, this is the face of LHG for most people who have been lucky enough to get down there in Bristol. It is, you know, truly a spectacular location. Best seen after dark, I think, because the way it's lit next to the river is just incredible. But, you know, it's at any time of day that it's open, it's a lovely sight, you know. So give us the background there.
Oh, geez. You know, I don't think, I'm 42 years old. I don't think I will ever undertake a project like that one again in my entire life. I think I'll look back on the 2 years that project took as being like a real point in my life. The building is so beautiful, you know, what it became, what the building was, where it was. Like, it was derelict, it was nothing. We were skint, you know, tiny, had no money. But it was such potentially iconic location that I couldn't see how we could not commit to it and try to make it happen. And it was like, there was just so, like, all the way through it with the crowdfund and then try to raise the funds to buy the building, you know, we bought the building, which was a huge part of that. You know, it was like, the level of investment that went into it, you know, that level of investment in a leased building would have been very painful. And it was very painful anyway, to be fair.
No, sure, but you need
at least at least it was appreciating an asset that we were, you know, we were parts in rather than just chucking money to make someone else's building better. But all sides to, you know, it was a project that was about £3 million for a company at a time that was turning over less than £1 million.
Oh, wow.
For a company that genuinely, I mean, we would have had £15,000-£20,000 in the bank through the journey of raising the money for that, like. You know, just right on the edge of it. But I felt so passionately that this could be something incredible.
Yep.
And if we could get it over the line, it could be utterly transformational for our business. And that happily, it turned out to be the case. And happily, all those little turns in the road that you know, you could have went one of two ways, that, that each time it transpired to be. The way that was the way forward, and we were able to raise the funds both via the crowdfund, via some borrowing, and going back to a crowdfund investors about 6 months later and raising another £300,000 off the same group. And do so without giving away, you know, the Rich Jack still owned 76.7% of the company. Did so, you know, took that massive leap forward without giving away so much of the company that we lost the ability to operate the company in the way that we see fit, and not the way that large investors might encourage us to. And I think that was important for us. You know, it's easy. It's easy to grow. It's easy to raise money. The question is how much of your business you have to give away to, in order to do so. How much of your
soul have you got to?
How much of your souls, your ethics, your morals that you're willing to sacrifice in order to do so? And we were really lucky, really super lucky that we were able to come through that journey and execute the purchase, the opening of the brew pub. And still maintain the majority ownership of a company and be able to make the right, in our opinion, the right decisions going forward. But I think you touched upon earlier on, I'll tell the story again. You know, I went to Newcastle, as the you know, that building at Finsels was on the market, and I was very, very intimidated by the prospect of buying this huge premises and attempting to raise the, you know, the millions of pounds that it was going to require to fit it out. And I went up to Newcastle and Dave showed me around the Palace of Arts. And, you know, it was the derelict building the first time I saw it. And I went back up a few months later for their opening party. And he just, it was just Wylands, incredible.
For those that don't know, Bruce.
Yes, beg your pardon. Yeah, the Palace of Arts, Newcastle, Wylands Brewery premises, which if people haven't seen it, Google it, look it up. It's incredible. And I was just blown away by Dave's ambition, his willingness to take on a project like that. But also so impressed by what a modern craft brewery could be. You know, everywhere I'd been to up until that point was like a warehouse. You know,
I know, with pallets to sit on and, it's
chucked together, you know, it's like, and they're lovely, you know, they've got.
Yeah, I'd love them. I spend half my life in places like that.
Yeah. Yeah, they've got soul and they've got character, but you know, they seen what Dave achieved up there, and I thought of that building down in Bristol, and I just thought, fuck it, like, but like that's the kind of ambition that we in the UK craft beer scene should have.
Yes,
and if we don't have, we'll never be what we could possibly be.
I totally agree. I
thought, fuck it, let's just commit, and then we will figure out in the way. and we did. Yeah. Step by step, and then opened the doors in June 2019, and the pandemic shut us down for 2 years. You know, there was a journey to be had there, but the headline is that the place has been incredible for our business. Like the level of turnover, the level of profit adds into our business, the level of impact, to the level of connectivity with our customers and our community, that position, right in the centre of the city. You know, we went from being, if you asked five people in Bristol who Left-Handed Giant were, maybe two people would say they knew, to being, if you asked five people who Left-Handed Giant are now, I think it's fair to say that five would say that those guys that have that massive building down off Castle Park.
Nice.
You know, went from being like, you know, we were kind of known to being like, I think, you know, it's like a landmark in the city centre.
Of course it is. Yeah.
You can't miss it. Like, as beautiful, as you said, that, like,
beautiful footbridge coming across the river in front as well. Yeah.
And you walk through Castle Park at night, you know, when the lights in that bridge are on, the lights in the brew pub, it's just that there's nowhere, you know, that is unique. It is, and it's really difficult to find things that you can do within your business that are genuinely unique. Everything has been done before, but I'll tell you what, that, you know, something that's not been done before. Things like it have been done, but no one else has a building like that in the middle of, you know, a city facing onto the water with that bendy bridge coming off the front of it, all those lights. No one else has that. That is ours. It's completely unique, and you see it and you recognise it, much like the Palace of Arts with Wylam in Newcastle. Like, it's, you know, that is uniquely ours. And it really has, you know, it's put us on the map, and it was worth, like, the stress and the pain of those 2 years, I think, took, you know, it's took you, you know, I wouldn't like to repeat it.
No, I can imagine, but it's something to be very proud of.
But worth every drop of, you know, tears and sweat that it took to get it done. Properly transformational for a business. Now, anyone that's not been there, you know, I said Google Wylam's Palace, Google, you know, Left Handed Giant Brew Pub, and have a look at the pictures of the place in the city centre. And I hope that it will inspire you and motivate you to, if you don't live in Bristol, to come and journey to Bristol.
There and make sure you drop in
come and see us. That's it. See where it all began. You know, you talked about the sky above earlier on, and that beer being designed to be drank from a glass in the pub. Like, that beer will never taste better than it does across the bar, straight from tank in the brew pub. You know, that is where it's at.
A nice combination of different seating environments there at the brew pub as well. But, you know, the lovely outdoor space, which is obviously is sheltered but still outdoors, which is brilliant. You know, I guess vagaries of the British weather and whatever. You've then got a really nice sort of, you know, if you want the full on being in the bar experience, you've got the downstairs area where you can almost reach out and touch the bar for your next beer. But then you can, you know, head up the stairs at the back, and you've got quite a peaceful upstairs area as well, where you're still looking down on the tanks and the bar, but you're not quite so sort of full on in the pub kind of thing there. So you know, you can pick your atmosphere wise, can't you?
And the top floor with the pool tables and the dartboards. You know, you can have whatever experience you want in there. Go and chill out in the top floor and have like a real like pub like environment, or sit down in the ground floor facing onto the tanks. Or as you said, out in the riverfront. It's just such an incredible. I'm always really critical of everything that we do within the business. I think it's really important. You know, it's important not to sit, you know, pat yourself in the back the whole time. It's important to look at what you do and be very critical, and strive to be better tomorrow than you were today, and to be better next year than you were this year. But it's difficult not to walk into that brew pub and just look at it and think what an incredible place it is, and be super proud of it.
No, definitely. So what's next for LHG, Bruce? Before you answer that question, let me read you a quote from, albeit that's a 2020 article, so it's not really...
What did I say?
Quote this back at you, but I'm going to do it just as a starter, and I don't hold you to this at all. But the quote that caught my eye was, "Our brewing facility is as big as it will ever be. We want to open up some great independent venues and sell more beer through the taps we own. Ultimately, this is an element of growth we can pursue without just making more beer." And that was in 2020, so that was pre-COVID.
That is super interesting, because I'm glad that's what I said, because that essentially is the, you know, that is the future. The reality is that the three years with the pandemic and then the cost of living crisis, inflationary stresses have only reinforced to us the place that we can really find stability and really lean into what we want the business to be is via our own venues. So since then, we've opened one more pub in Bristol via partnership project. So we opened a small business with a couple of people that used to work within Left Handed Giant, called the Old Bookshop in North Street. But this year, we intend to open another couple of premises in Bristol, one of which will be a proper Left-Handed Giant brew pub type, you know, tanks within the venue, and then hopefully another venue in the city centre as well, which will be not a Left-Handed Giant venue, but under a Left-Handed Giant banner, if that, like a small bar type of venue where it's you know, it's a craft beer, Left-Handed Giant as well, but adding to the craft beer scene in Bristol, Giving us some volume from left-handed giant, adding to our turnover and our profit margins in the business. But that really is it. You know, it's like we don't still have no desire really to open bars outside of Bristol. You know, as I said to you earlier on, like my previous job was running bars the length of the bleeding country.
Yeah.
Didn't enjoy both the travel, but also the relationship that I had with the people that worked in the bars. You know, I was some guy that rolled up every couple of weeks. And spoke to the manager and then buggered off again, having usually told someone off or something.
Yeah, sure.
I much prefer the environment where we are close together. Everyone can know each other. And we feel like, there's a sense of community with each other. So very much Bristol-based. The reality is that currently we are operating at about 80% of our total capacity, so we can make more beer from our existing breweries. So we hope we can open another couple of venues this year and keep the sales that we already have, and hopefully brew at 100% capacity to supply the bars that we open up this year.
Yeah.
But I would imagine that there'll be another bar or two in our future over the next 2 to 3 years. We're not talking about opening 20 bars throughout Bristol. That's not the plan.
No.
The plan is to be a small independent business, not to be a constantly growing business. But actually, there's been a fair amount of talk about growth within this conversation. And it's probably worth saying as well that one of our ambitions is to not always be seeing growth as one of our KPIs.
Right.
I think there's a real problem in business generally that there's an expectation of growth.
Growth doesn't have to be the case. In the end all,
That's it. Doesn't have, you can get to a point where your turnover and your profits are sufficient and you can focus on how great the environment is for the customers, how great the product is, how great the environment is for your team. You can focus on trying to increase the profit margin against your turnover, trying to work on efficiencies rather than working on top line turnover growth.
So
I would like to get to a point where growth is no longer the thing at the front of our mind. And honestly, I thought that point was not far off. Now the inflation that we have seen over the last year have had such an impact into our margins. I'm afraid we probably have to go through a period of growth all over again to allow ourselves to make up for the loss of margin that we've
definitely
had. But that's just, it's part of business reacting to what gets laid out in front of you rather than sticking to the plan that you had in the first place. And obviously beyond that, so you've got some venues in town. We've got two good brewing facilities. As I said, there's volume within those brewing facilities to be utilized for the new venues. No growth really expected beyond more venues of our own. And then obviously, the far side of that is buying shares back off of our crowdfund investors and then passing shares on to our employees. And that'll be the project, hopefully 2 to 3 years in the future. But there's a whole other side to it. So we're about to announce we've just went through a year-long project to become net zero. So we've now achieved that. So all of the reporting, all of the work that's went behind that is about to get released onto our website. It'll be a big sort of drive round about making people aware of what we've done, we're doing, what we plan to do. Mm-hmm. And we've also just submitted our B Corp application. So that just went in week before last. So hopefully at some point through the next 6 months, we'll become a certified B Corp as well.
Awesome.
So I guess that's it. Even within a small, we are a small business, there's always things going on, between new venues, between sustainability, between our social environmental responsibilities and all the things to do with employee ownership in the background. Never every year that comes along, and I think it'll be a nice, relaxing year, and then something happens.
No, that's never going to happen.
But you know what? I love it.
You can dream. But there's a lot to be proud of there Bruce. Something else you guys should be proud of is the Little Summer Beer Bash, which is your turn to host this year.
It is.
That's I was at Daya. Goodness, how many years ago was that? Four years ago? I don't know.
In God. Yeah, 2000 and was that 19? I think that was 19. That was 2019.
We had tickets for Verdant. Didn't end up going in the end, actually, this year. We bought tickets for Verdant the previous year. Didn't happen. Last summer, didn't actually get there, much to my shame.
Oh, that's such a shame.
Yeah. But I'm not going to miss your one this year. So
good.
Tell us about how that's going to, where are you going to host it? Is the first question, I guess.
It will be, so we now have a far bigger facility in St. Phillip's than we had the year that we hosted it in 2017, 18. So we've got a yard that's capable of a facility inside and a yard that's capable of holding more than enough people. Big stretch tent outside. So yeah, it's a very, very, very different facility out there than the one that we hosted in 2018. It'll be a one-day festival, same as it's always been, two sessions through a Saturday. There's a date, I can't remember when it is, but it'll be announced in all the social media channels in the next probably month, I would think.
Oh, brilliant.
We've just went through a whole pile of planning. I've been very little involved in this.
Your people have.
other people's hard work here. The guys in the brood, there's been a whole bunch of work over the course of the last 2 or 3 months, culminating in a meeting I was involved in that was finalising the beer lineups of the breweries. So the brewery lineup has been finalised.
Excellent.
And I'm not going to talk about it here for fear of stealing the thunder of the social media announcements, but awesome. It's an incredibly exciting lineup that has that lovely combination of breweries that Little Summer Beer Bash has always had. You know, it's people that we're really close to, people that we've had long-term relationships with, people that are new into the beer scene, and give them a platform to showcase their beers. And then some international people that we've got great relationships with too, but it's always such a lovely day, whether it's here, Day of Verdun, of like a sense of coming together of like a really lovely community of people.
Nice. It is unique in UK festival.
I'm glad you said that, because I really do think it is. It's something I'm super, super proud to be a part of.
Festivals are getting really big, and who knows, we all love big beer festivals, but yours is that one is intimate, isn't it? It's there's I don't know how many 20-25 breweries, whatever, plenty of choice,
number 25, that area will be the answer this year. And 500 people, it's not about really making money at all. It's just about having a fun day, and inviting all of our friends around to come and hang out and drink some beer and have a a lovely day, drinking some great beer in a great environment.
And I guess you have uniquely compared to your two partners in that event is you've got the other retail footprint as well, where you can have some fringe events and have some tap takeovers from your guests. So that's really nice. Yes. I'm sure the whole weekend.
We've got events on, I believe, the Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and possibly in the Sunday as well. But there's events on from the visiting breweries all the way in about it. Yeah. So it'll be a proper, there's a big day on the Saturday, but it'll just be a lovely weekend.
Awesome.
I hope a lot of people will come to Bristol. I make a weekend of it rather than just come along for the Saturday, a weekend and enjoy themselves, just enjoying the Bristol beer scene.
Best place for people to get their hands on some LHG beers?
In Bristol, at our venue, straight across the bar, straight from the tank.
Nice selection of venues to suit every every atmosphere and desire. Yeah, so good answer. People that can't get to Bristol.
Yeah, the beer gets sent all over the country. Mm-hmm. I would like to think that if you go into any good independent bar or bottle shop, certainly bottle shop, you're likely to find a can.
I'd be surprised.
And from a bar perspective, our beer goes out via wholesalers and direct into almost every city. The best thing to do is look at social media and see where it's popping up. But certainly from it, and also obviously you've got via the website you can access the cans. If you can't find it within bottle shops or bars in the city you're in, you can jump on the website and access the cans via the website. But having said that, I would much rather that people went to the bottle shops in their local area and accessed it via there rather than jumping our website and bypass them and increase the carbon footprint of the business by sending beer through Royal Mail.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. All right, then let's get into the wrap-up questions, Bruce.
Go.
And the first one is really easy, actually. This is what I call a shout-out to a little guy. And here I ask you to name one or more local to Bristol beer businesses that you think are doing a great job promoting independent craft beer. So that can be another brewery, a tap room, a bottle shop, a pub, even a restaurant or a cafe, but something that you're really proud of for the work they're doing promoting independent craft beer, not just LHG, but the scene in general.
There is a bottle shop in Cheltenham called Favourite Beers. That is one of the best little bottle shops that exists in this country.
Okay. Nice.
The guy that owns it knows more than most, has the place set up perfectly. And if anyone, yeah, he's been such a supporter of us through the course of it, right from day one when we used to bottle into those little stubbies. And he by all rights probably should have told us to beat it and come back when we package beer properly. and he didn't. Go and check out favourite beers.
No, good answer. I'm happy with that. So we are at the wrap-up question. And here I need to know, what would be your ultimate happy hour? And there are three parts to this question. I need to know where you would be, who you would be with, and most specifically, what beer you would be drinking. And the one qualifier is the beer doesn't need to match the venue necessarily. So in this fantasy world, you can bring the beer with you if it wouldn't usually be available there.
I may just jump back in time.
All right, that's cool.
I'd place myself into an environment that I was in a lot for a little space of time, and I'll place myself into the Golden Rule, and I'll be drinking a pint of Jarl from Fine Ales with my brother.
Okay, nice. Yes, good choices. Good choices. Yeah, you'd be surprised actually how many guests on this podcast do go for a pint of cask rather than an Imperial Stout or a dipper or whatever, which you might expect. But that's fine.
My brother and I have not lived in the same place since I was 15 and he moved to Edinburgh. Right. And there was a very, very brief 3-month period where we both lived in Edinburgh.
Nice.
And we both lived very close to each other in Polwarth. And the Golden Rule, obviously, obviously, the Golden Rule's in Polwarth. It's a great little pub. Right. And him and I spent a great deal of time down there playing board games, drinking Jarl and chatting. And I think back to that time with a great deal of fondness, not least because it was a period of time where I was just starting with BrewDog and really leaning into learning about beer, what beer was. And going through that journey. So yeah, I've got a lot of fondness for that time. Golden Rule and Jarl with my brother Colin.
Good answer. Do you ever get up to the Fine Fest festival?
We do. So my wife, I and our kids went up just before the pandemic.
Right.
For the first time, because we poured beer there prior to that. And we went up, had the most amazing time, committed to going back every year thereafter, and then the pandemic happened and we've not been back since.
Very much on my to-do list. I haven't been there.
Have you not been?
I've driven past the end, the road where the brewery is, because you're cutting around the lock there, aren't you? I did that last summer, but I didn't stop, I'm afraid.
Yeah, it's such a lovely thing. The people are so lovely. It's such a great brewery. And actually, it's like, I think back to that time drinking Jarl and Hurricane Jack, actually. They had that on quite frequently too in the Golden Rule. Really enjoying that beer and starting to learn about beer and what it was. And now, I know the people at Fine now. I know who they are and what they are. And I'm so glad that they're such lovely people. Because it really does marry up with, my perception of what that beer was and, the product itself. It's such a nice thing.
Brilliant. Bruce, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you very much for your time. Thanks for your contribution to the UK scene, because I think you guys are absolutely cornerstones and stalwarts and, all the other cliches. But I think, you've got an amazing business down there in Bristol. I love what you've achieved so far, and I'm really looking forward to seeing how this summer goes with a little summer beer bash and everything else beyond that. But in the meantime, it's been lots of fun. Thank you very much.
I really appreciate it. I really appreciate your comments there. I really appreciate your time. It allowed me the chance to have a chat in the podcast. I really, really enjoyed it.
Perfect. Thanks very much.